Thank you very much, Mark. It seems like it's the year for 50th anniversaries, because not only is it Cedars and Coffee's 50th anniversary, it's also the Reserve Bank of Australia's 50th anniversary this year. I have to apologise, I don't have a video to show you, though. But if you walk up to the top of Martin Place to where our building is, you'll see a fantastic photographic wrap around the building, which has some great historical photos of Sydney, which I recommend to you. As you may know, recently the Reserve Bank released its latest statement on monetary policy. So this morning what I want to do is to take up three of the themes that were discussed in that document. The first of these is the two-speed global economy. The second is the resilience of the Australian economy, and the third is the moderation that we've seen in inflation in Australia. A year ago, when this conference was held, the world economy did really look like it was standing on the edge of a precipice. Output was contracting, international trade was falling, consumer and business confidence were declining, risk aversion was extreme. And at the time, there were serious economic observers who were talking about the very real possibility of a rerun of the problems of the 1930s. As we now know, the world economy has moved back from the edge. Output grew by around 3% over the final 9 months of last year. International trade has recovered. Confidence has improved somewhat and risk aversion has abated. As a result, many observers are now predicting that global growth will be around 4% this year and next, and that's clearly a much better outcome than was feared likely earlier last year. And one reason that we've moved back from the edge is the policy responses of governments and central banks. These responses provided the public with the assurance that policymakers would not stand idly by while things collapsed around them. And collectively, they've been sufficient to interrupt this corrosive cycle of falling confidence, undermining spending, then feeding through into even lower confidence in incomes and even lower spending. The pickup, though, that we've seen in the world economy has been quite uneven. In the advanced economies, the recovery has been weak, especially in light of the very large contractions in output that have occurred. In contrast, though, in Asia, the bounce back has been much stronger, and many of the economies in the region are growing solidly and they're operating with much less spare capacity than in the advanced economies. And as we look forward, I think this two-speed nature of the world economy is likely to be with us for some time, perhaps some years. In the advanced economies, growth has returned to most of them, although this has much to do with the dynamics of the inventory cycle and the boost of spending from various fiscal measures. While it's not unusual that these type of factors play a major role in the early part of a recovery, a stronger pickup in private demand in these countries is going to be required for a sustainable, durable expansion. And as you can see from this first graph here, both consumption and investment in the major countries is still very weak, and individuals and businesses remain very cautious. Again, looking forward, the central scenario for most of these economies remains a subdued recovery. It's likely that many of them will continue to be weighed down by the desire of households to reduce leverage and to increase their savings. And with considerable excess capacity, the prospects for a strong recovery in business investment do not look particularly strong. Many of the advanced economies have very weak financial sectors, which have very little appetite for risk, and many also face very significant medium-term fiscal challenges that will need to be addressed. If history is any guide here, overcoming these financial headwinds will take considerable time, as I said, perhaps many years. The picture in Asia, though, is very different. A number of economies have had V-shaped recoveries, and as you can see from this chart, this is particularly evident in the data on industrial production and trade. In many of them, unemployment rates are now coming down, and unlike in the advanced economies, core inflation has troughed and starting to rise. Throughout the region, the stimulatory settings of both monetary and fiscal policy that were put in place have in fact proved an effective antidote to the problems emanating from the large North Atlantic countries. The region's also avoided the financial headwinds created by a troubled financial sector and high and rising levels of public debt. As you know, the recovery has been strongest in China, with the economy there growing by around 8.75% last year. This strong recovery in China has provided a boost to many other economies in Asia and outside Asia as well. As you can see from this next graph, Chinese imports have grown particularly strongly over the last little while, and Chinese exports are also up strongly. In the middle of the year, the growth in China was driven by strong growth in public sector infrastructure spending. But more recently, there's been some rebalancing, with exports growing strongly and consumption also rising solidly. Now, the challenges that face China are clearly different from those facing the advanced economies. Foremost amongst these challenges is deciding how and when to scale back some of the policy stimulus that had been put in place. As many observers have noted, if the stimulus remains in place too long, there is a risk of overheating, and that would lead to difficulties down the track. For calibrating the withdrawal of the stimulus is difficult, and there are clearly risks here in both directions. On balance, though, I think it is plausible to argue that the recent tightening in credit conditions that we have seen in China is a favourable development, in that it increases the likelihood of sustained expansion of the Chinese economy. Time will, of course, tell. This two-speed world presents a very interesting backdrop for the Australian economy. There remains some risk that developments in the advanced economies could again derail growth in the global economy, including that in Asia. But the more likely scenario remains a relatively subdued recovery in the advanced economies and strong growth in Asia, with domestic demand in the region playing a much more important role than it has done historically. Now, if this is how things play out, the Australian economy is very well placed. Around 70% of our exports now go to Asia, and the strong growth in the region is supporting many commodity prices. This is reflected in our terms of trade, which you can see from this graph are expected to increase strongly over the next year from what's already at a very high level. So this brings me to my second theme, the general resilience of the Australian economy. Amongst the advanced economies, Australia is the only one to have avoided an experience of negative year-end growth during the global downturn. Activity did contract in the final quarter of 2008, but it's likely to have grown by around 2% in 2009. This is a considerably better outcome than thought likely a year ago, and it's led the bank to revise up its growth forecast for 2010 and for 2011. Much of this upward revision occurred between the middle of last year and November, and we've only made relatively modest revisions since then. As you can see in this next chart, our central forecast is for the economy to grow by around 3.25% to 3.5% over each of the next couple of years. This is slightly above the average rate of growth for the past two decades, and if it occurred, would see a gradual reduction in some of the spare capacity that currently exists. This general outlook is based on the judgment that growth in private demand will gradually strengthen, with public demand providing support to activity in the short term. The housing sector is now firmly in the upswing phase of the construction cycle. Investment in the resources sector is likely to increase very strongly, and that will see investment as a share of GDP return to the very high levels that we saw in late 2008. In terms of consumption, we're expecting reasonably solid growth, although below the pace of the previous years, as households take a more cautious approach to their finances. There's one technical issue regarding these forecasts that I'd like to draw your attention to, and that's the assumption about interest rates that the bank staff use when putting the forecast together. For some years, it had been our practice to assume that the cash rate remained unchanged right through the forecast horizon. Now, this approach had the obvious advantage of simplicity, but when the cash rate's a long way from its normal level, it's not particularly realistic. So in August last year, we changed our approach. Since then, we've been preparing our forecasts on the technical assumption that the cash rate returns towards a more normal setting over time. Our overall objective here is to provide the community with a general sense of how we think the economy is likely to evolve over the next few years, and to do this, we need to make realistic assumptions. Broadly speaking, the paths that we have used have been similar to those implied by market interest rates at the time the forecasts were prepared. It's important to stress, though, that this neither implies a commitment by the board to the particular path used by the staff or an endorsement by the bank of the market pricing at the time. Now, one aspect of our recent economic performance that stands out in particular is the performance of the labour market. As you can see here, the unemployment rate peaked at around 5.75% last year. Again, this is a much better outcome than earlier thought likely, and it's been very important in underpinning a high level of confidence in the community. In turn, the high level of confidence has short-circuited what could have been a damaging dynamic, that is, rising unemployment feeding through into weak confidence and lower incomes, in turn feeding into lower spending, lower confidence, and a further rise in unemployment. Now, there are a number of factors that have helped deliver this positive outcome, but the one I want to highlight today is the flexibility of our labour market. In previous economic downturns, when the demand for labour declined, people lost their jobs almost one for one with the decline in labour demand. But on this occasion, things have turned out quite differently, with the increase in the unemployment rate being smaller than would have been suggested by historical relationships between unemployment and output. This is partly because many firms and their employees agreed to reduce working hours rather than reduce the number of people working in the firm. In other cases, there was an agreement that wage increases would be reduced or delayed as a way of preserving jobs. And the good news here is that this flexibility actually worked. It worked in limiting job losses in the economy. This has had obvious social benefits, and as I said before, it has supported overall confidence in the community. I think without this flexibility of our labour market, the outcomes would not have been as favourable. But looking beyond the labour market, there are a number of issues that we are paying particular attention to at the moment as we try and gauge the current pulse of the economy. And I'd like to briefly touch on three of these. The first is the weakness in business credit. Over the past year, business credit has fallen by 7%. And as you can see here, the last time we saw anything like this was in the early 1990s, when the economy clearly was in a deep recession and investment was collapsing. And making an assessment of why this contraction in business credit is occurring is difficult, but in all probability it reflects both demand and supply factors. In the commercial property area, the supply of finance remains constrained, and many lenders have little appetite to increase their commercial property exposures. On the other hand, the demand for loans by many businesses in the broader economy appears to have declined. Many firms have used equity raisings and their cash reserves to pay down debt, and as a result, the rate at which loans are being repaid by the business sector is historically high. You can see that in the bottom part of this chart. I think over time, as the economy strengthens and investment picks up, a reversal in these trends in business credit would be expected. The second issue is the evidence of ongoing cautiousness by the household and business sectors at a time when confidence is apparently very high. This cautiousness can not only be seen in the business credit figures, but also in household spending plans and in surveys of firms' investment intentions, which remain below average, despite confidence being above average. It appears that one legacy of the global downturn is that many people, despite being confident about the future, are taking a conservative approach to their spending. And as we go forward, one of the things that will clearly shape how the economy evolves is how these attitudes change. The third issue that I'd like to talk about is the timing of whether the timing of expenditure in the economy has been affected by temporary fiscal measures. Through much of last year, a question that was commonly asked both in Australia and elsewhere was whether the signs of recovery that we were seeing reflected primarily fiscal measures. One concern was that once these measures were over, spending would decline. Now, around the world, it's clear that temporary fiscal measures have had significant effects on the timing of spending. The best example of this is probably the cask scrappage schemes that we've seen in a number of the advanced economies. In Australia, we've also seen some of these effects, particularly with the increased first homeowners grant and the temporary tax deductions for business investment. As you can see in this chart here, these deductions have had a very significant increase on the pattern of car sales to businesses, rising very strongly in the June and December quarters. Now, looking forward, it remains possible that with some of these measures having been wound back, that activity could again slow. However, as time has passed, the likelihood of this being the case looks to have declined. Household spending has held up better over the second half of 2009 than expected. And over recent months, there's been some evidence to suggest that the purchase of various services by the household sector has been strong. One example of this is the very strong growth in spending on restaurants, cafes and takeaway food, which you can see in this chart here. This type of spending is unlikely to be related to temporary fiscal measures. More broadly, the expansion of the resources sector and the improvement in Australia's terms of trade reflect structural developments in the world economy and not temporary fiscal measures in Australia. I'd now like to move to the third area, which is the moderation of inflation that we've seen in Australia. If we go back to the September quarter of 2008, the year-ended inflation rate in underlying terms was a little over 4.5%. It's now around 3.25%, with the outcome for the December quarter around 0.6%. That's a marked step down from the rates that we'd seen in the previous quarters. This moderation that we've seen is in line with what we'd been expecting for some time, and it reflects three broad factors: the slowing in wage growth in the private sector, the appreciation of the exchange rate, and an increase in spare capacity in the economy. Now, these factors all take time to fully work their way through, so we expect a period of further modest quarterly outcomes in underlying inflation and thus further moderation in the year-ended rate over the coming quarters. Now, one issue that's attracted some attention recently is how the bank actually assesses the rate of underlying inflation. I want to point out here that we do not have a mechanical approach. We don't have a secret formula. What we're trying to do is to discern the average rate of prices increases in the economy, abstracting from unusually large movements. And at any point in time, we're looking at a whole range of price changes in the economy, and we're using various analytical techniques to try and derive the measure of central tendency. Now, inevitably, these different measures, which I'm showing here, produce slightly different outcomes. But as you can see, the general pattern over time is the same. There's no unambiguously right measure of underlying inflation, so we look at them all. And then using all this information, we make a general assessment of underlying inflation. Now, we do all this because we found it a useful input into thinking about how inflation is likely to evolve over time, particularly the CPI, the headline rate of inflation, which, after all, is our objective. As we go through the process of putting our forecast together, we need to understand the recent price pressures in the economy, and we found it useful to look at these measures of underlying inflation. But as I said, the emphasis here is very much forward-looking and thinking about how the CPI is likely to evolve over the next couple of years. Our latest inflation forecast was set out a few weeks ago in the Statement of Monetary Policy. And as you can see from this graph, we expect the CPI inflation rate to be around 2.5% this year, and just a little higher in 2011. These forecasts are a small upward revision to those set out a few months ago. This largely reflects the fact the economy looks to have less spare capacity than thought likely in the middle of last year. So to sum up, the Australian economy clearly finds itself in a much better position than other advanced economies. We've come through the global downturn much better than expected, and unlike the other advanced economies, employment has recently grown strongly here and the level of investment is very high. We are also clearly benefiting from high commodity prices and from our strong trade links with Asia. Inflation's moderating, as expected, and it is likely to be consistent with the medium-term target over the next couple of years. Now, risks, of course, remain around this outlook, particularly both in the advanced economies and in Asia. But the central scenario for Australia over the next couple of years remains a positive one. And so the challenges that we are likely to face look to be quite different to those facing the other advanced economies of the world. Thank you very much for your time.
David Byers, CEDA. I just had a question about China, which featured heavily in Phil's and Rob's presentations. And I read an analysis recently which said that effectively urbanisation in China is done, or at least it's at the high end, that therefore infrastructure development has really gone about as far as it can go for the foreseeable future, and also that it simply can't continue at its current growth rates. So the question really is, and I suppose linking back as well to the huge stimulus package, picking up one that occurred in China and picking up one of Henry's themes, how well was that really done given the amount of money that was invested in the Chinese economy? So the question is, how confident are we about the continuation of the China growth story? And if it turns out not to be the case, is that a source of vulnerability, therefore, for the Australian economy over the next decade?
Perhaps I'll start off here. If you look at the capital to output ratio in China, it's still very low. I haven't seen the analysis you're referring to, but most of the other analysis that I've seen suggests the urbanisation process has a long way to run. The housing stock in China is still, in many parts of the country, still a rather low quality. The transportation networks outside the major cities still need a lot of investment. The road networks, outside the major cities, are still being constructed. So I think to argue that somehow China has overdone capital investment, I think that's a stretch. I think they can go for many years with extraordinarily high levels of investment as their capital ratio gradually rises. So I'm quite optimistic that that story has got some decades to run. And that's underlying my general optimism about prospects for the Australian economy. I mean, there are clearly going to be ups and downs. There'll be cycles in Chinese investment. There'll be slowdowns and periods in which they speed up. And that will have an effect on us. So it's important that our economy remains flexible so that it can deal with the inevitable swings both in the Chinese and the global economy. But the next 20 years, I think, is going to be a very good, on average, is going to be a very good 20 years for China. And that's going to help us.
This is Jennifer Hewitt from the Australian. A question to Phil, Philip and Rob. We've had a fairly strong criticism of the efficiency of the government's fiscal stimulus measures from Henry, and a defence really of their effectiveness in terms of the economy from Philip and Rob. I was wondering, you mentioned, Philip, the impact of the first homeowners grant and business tax deductions in terms of investment. Do you think, could you just talk about one of the more controversial aspects of that, the whole school stimulus building program? What do you think the effectiveness of that was, and whether or not there is a case to, in fact, withdraw that a lot more rapidly and run it down than the government is at present intending?
I'm not going to talk about the specifics of that program, but I think there's a general point here that the various fiscal measures, did help support economic activity through 2009. You can just look at the graph that Rob showed in the month of December at the end of 2008. There was a significant increase in consumer spending, and then again in the first quarter of 2009 when the cash payments were made. So I think it's undeniable that that helped support the economy through a period, that period. Part of it is just changing the timing of expenditure, but that in itself is a benefit, because when private demand was very weak, some of these temporary government programs actually brought demand into a period where private demand was very weak, and so has provided an offset. As the economy strengthens, these measures will need to be wound back, and under the government's plans, they will be wound back. And the issue is the speed and timing of that, and I'm not going to comment any further on that.